اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد.
إمام عاصي, I go back to know him in the late 70s or early 80s when he used to come to Houston for lectures. When I was involved with ISGH, Islamic Society of Greater Houston, before the revolution and my involvement with Anjuman after the revolution. That was a long time ago. And then I was involved in ICNA when you founded it. Brother Asi was born in Grand Rapids, Michigan. At the age of 11, he moved to Lebanon. There, he completed high school and attended the Arab University of Beirut, where he intensively studied the Arabic language. In 1973, Imam Asi returned to the United States and attended the University of Maryland, graduating with a degree in government and politics in 1979. Imam Asi is active in the Global Islamic Magazine. Which is the Crescent International News Magazine. We used to receive it in the 80s. I don't know if it's still, I think it was Brother Zafar in Canada, yes. He was the imam who formerly led prayer at the Islamic Center Imam Asi is the imam who formerly led prayer at the Islamic Center of Washington. And I remember in 1992 when we went for Yom Kodesh, it was snowing and we prayed outside, if you still remember it, Imam. He was elected as the Imam of the Islamic Center in 1981. In March 1983, Imam Asi was expelled from the center for preaching truthful views on particular subjects regarding the US policy. Although he still identifies himself as Imam of the Islamic Center, the center has stated that it has no affiliation with him. One of the guys who was assigned there, I asked him for a debate, Brother Shaker Sayed, before he left Houston, because he was always preaching the division of Muslims and always degrading the faith of Islam followed by the Shias. When I asked him for a debate, I called him, they told me he moved to Washington. Imam Asi still holds Jum'ah khutbas, which I just told you, every Friday on the sidewalk in front of the Islamic Center in protest of his undemocratic expulsion. He frequently speaks at universities across the United States, Canada, and Europe. He currently spends most of his time working on ideological elucidation of Islamic principles, particularly the first English tafsir. I don't know the English word, exegesis. of the Holy Quran. 17 volumes have been completed, out of which 6 volumes have been published. Thank you very much, Brother Asi. It is titled The Ascendant Quran and is attainable from Amazon. We encourage everyone to get copies of that. Brother Asi, you're welcome here among your brothers and sisters, and we are waiting and eager to hear your speech. Please, let's welcome him by a big salat of Muhammad and Ali Muhammad.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله الذي لا يحمد على مكروه سواه وصلى الله على محمد وآل محمد اللهم صل على محمد. Dear brothers and sisters, السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. I would like to begin by thanking all of you who are here this late afternoon, and in particular those who combined their efforts to organize this commemoration of the passing away of the late Imam, may Allah rest his soul in eternal peace. I would like to also express my appreciation for the attendance of the scholars and the well-informed Muslims among you for your presence here at this program. I would like to begin by saying that obviously Al-Imam al-Khumayni rahmatullahi alayhi had a lifetime that is rich in experience and in lessons that we can all learn from. Sometimes Muslims are slow learners. You get to observe that from what is happening in today's world, which I will get to in the course of the presentation. Trying to relay to you some of the, what you may consider, limelight moments of his lifetime is going to have to be a selective process. I'm going to have to pick out certain incidents or certain events in his life that will hopefully shed some light on our current affairs. I think the most remarkable breakthrough that the late Imam presented to us was what may be called a game changer. In the, some of you are old enough to remember the bipolar world. We had something like a political game that was being played out by two superpowers. They had a monopoly on world affairs, more or less. And they were playing this exchange of geographical areas. You take this country, we take that country. We'll challenge you in this part of the world. We will counter-challenge you in another part of the world. And that was going on back and forth between the United States and the Soviet Union. And they thought that they had a ironclad control of more or less world affairs. They never expected something to break out of their control. And that is precisely what happened with the leadership of Imam al-Khomeini and the Islamic Revolution in Iran. Something unpredictable happened. And that was that for the first time on the watch of these superpowers, there was a truly sovereign and independent leadership and country. Something that threw their political game into a tizzy. They did not expect that a geographical area, a substantial geographical area in the world right now, no longer reports to Moscow or Washington. And this, if we take a closer look at it, this is attributable to the revolutionary, and mind you, the word revolutionary is seldomly used. We hope maybe now the tide is turning, but in the past 10, 15 years, 20 years even, people who used to use the word revolutionary dropped it from their vocabulary. They don't use it anymore. But now, I think things are beginning to happen, even in the context of the non-Muslims, that will, I think, usher in a new stage or a new chapter in which the word revolutionary will be in vogue once again. The revolutionary idea that brought about this radical change in world politics can be summed up by two words, which were mentioned earlier a few times. Those two words are walayatul faqih. Just for those who know a little Arabic, I just want to make, there's a common mistake. Many people pronounce it wilayatul faqih. It is walayatul faqih. But we're not here for a linguistic course. Simply stated, this revolutionary idea gave Islamic scholars the enlightenment and orientation to assume the civic, the social, the political, the military, in other words, state responsibilities, which was not, prior to this, an idea that was very popular. Muslims and even non-Muslims had resigned themselves to the fact that superpowers more or less are in charge, and there's nothing much we can do about it. So we either have to live with what we have in a very passive manner. We may not agree with it, but you know, let's just live with it. Or there could be some expressions of opposition from individuals here and there. But never was it to snowball into a popular movement that could knock out a subservient regime, as was that of the Pahlavi of Iran. This idea to some individuals, and some of them may fashion themselves as scholars, was a negative addition to the Islamic literature. They didn't feel comfortable with this. And here we encounter a psychology that, because of the peculiar history that we have, a psychology that just could not muster enough confidence to say, we can do it. Imam al-Khomeini, may the mercy of Allah be upon him, at this particular juncture said to those who were opposed to this idea, whether they were internally opposed or externally opposed, it didn't matter. He said, we can move forward and it can be done. And he began his opposition to the regime of the Shah early on in the 50s and 60s in the Hawza. And it went through phases. He was expelled from the Hawza. He had to go into exile to Turkey and then to Al-Najaf in Al-Iraq. And from there, gradually, with Allah's assistance, a revolutionary momentum began to pick up until finally it caught on. And the regime, the government of Iran at that time was considered to be an American stronghold in the area. That American point of reference in all of the politics of the what they call the Middle East crumbled. We all saw how that happened. Some of the unspoken details, and I was mentioning earlier, there is an effort now. It's been an effort underway for the past 8 years or more, to factually collect all the information pertaining to the years that led up to the revolution, to the years of those turbulent clashes that took place that resulted in the expiration of an American client regime in the area, and the emergence of an Islamic Republic, and then throughout the war years, the years of war, culminating in the passing away of the late Imam Quddisa Sirruhu Sharif. This effort is in progress. I don't know where exactly they are, but when it is finished, it will present us with the facts about what had happened throughout all of these years. But one of the unspoken realities of the life of the Imam is he did not know fear. Many Muslims nowadays are gripped by fear. I don't know why, but they just fear. It's as if, you know, some of them even fear from their own shadows. Some of them fear to come to a meeting like this. Fear, what are we doing? What is there to fear? What is there that's scary? If you do something wrong, then you fear.
Allahu Akbar. Allahu Akbar. Allahu Akbar.
But no one's doing anything wrong. So how does this fear come in? Where does it come from? One of the lesser known details of the life of the late Imam is when he was returning before, there are two incidents, before he returned from Paris, while he was still in Paris, in exile. Not even a Muslim country would accept him. Kuwait initially said yes, and he said no, and then no other. Still the same rulers, the same rotten royal families that rule there could not accept a person who expresses his conscience and his mind on the matter. When the Imam was in Paris, and the Shah, receiving American advisors, political and military, and his henchmen, the generals and all, what are we going to do? This thing is getting out of hand. People are in the streets. There are demonstrations everywhere. What is there? What are we going to do? So they came up with the idea, let's place an opposition figure as something like an interim ruler of the country and have the Shah leave Iran and bring in this character called Shahpur Bakhtiar. Let's bring him in and have him rule. During the time in the past, he was considered an opponent of the Shah. He was put in prison for that, so some type of credibility here. So let's bring him in and try to negotiate something with this religious person in exile in Paris. So this Bakhtiar and his circle of confidants, they began to leak information to the Imam. Look, we are willing to accept much of what you are all about. Let's sit down and broker a deal. This was the words coming from Iran to the Imam. So the Imam's advisors, some individuals around him, approached him and said, this is what they are saying. These people in Tehran right now, the Shah is on his way out. Bakhtiar is right now the person that's in charge, and he's saying, you know, he has a whole package of reforms. What is it that you want to be reformed and he's willing to accept? The Imam said, he has to go. Now, you take that incident, that one development in his life, and put it in today's world. Today's world, there's what the Western mainstream media calls the Arab Spring. And we have some Islam, quote unquote, Islamic leaders who are being offered the same thing. Look, let's broker a deal here. What do you want? Let's work something out. You want some ministers in the government. You want to become the prime minister. You want this portfolio. You want that position, whatever it is. Let's work something out. You look at Morocco, you look at Tunisia, you look at Egypt, you look at Libya and other places. All of these things are going on. We haven't heard, I haven't heard, any one of these leaders who said to these interlocutors, the whole system has to go. None of them. To the contrary, some of them have been coming to Washington, D.C. and explaining to the Americans, hey, look, you have nothing, the American officials, look, you have nothing to fear. We're your friends. We can work things out. There's a troubling aspect to this. Another limelight or another significant development that we are still living with is the liberation of Palestine. Some shuyukh who report to Saudi royalty have almost turned neurotic. They say that, and this is a problem, you see, Muslims have a problem. Nothing wrong with looking at ourselves and saying, look, we have a problem. The problem that these particular type of individuals have, and they are somewhere located in the leading role of Islamic movements. They say, we have a problem. Actually, it is a problem made up of two components. One of them is Zionism. Listen, brothers and sisters, I want you to listen to this very carefully, because this is not some person who is isolated, an individual's opinion. This comes from high up in certain quarters that, as I said, they give an Islamic appearance, but behind the scenes, they report to their financial masters in the Arabian Peninsula. They say, we have a problem, we have a dual problem. It is Zionism, and this is their word. I'm not saying this because this is the occasion today. I'm saying this because this is the fact. Zionism and Wilayat al-Faqih. They say that's their problem. You would expect something like this to come from maybe an uninformed person, or maybe someone who is maliciously and in the raw anti-Islamic. You would never expect this to come from people who are supposed to know better. But that's exactly what is happening in today's world. And then they quote, they say, they don't even say it, Imam al-Khomeini. They say al-Khomeini at one time had a meeting after the Islamic Revolution. He had a meeting with his closest advisors, and he said to them that this Islam, now this is a statement that is perfectly normal and perfectly Islamic and perfectly reasonable. He said, this Islamic revolution, I'm paraphrasing, this Islamic revolution is directionless or meaningless without the liberation of Palestine. Something everyone should understand. Anyone who has an Islamic pulse in them would understand that if we are going to have an Islamic polity, an Islamic political order, then eventually what that would mean, if it is to take its course, is the liberation of Palestine. Something very normal, very logical. But these people say, no, Khomeini, what he meant with that is he wanted to gain popularity. Look at the way they're looking at things. Look at the way they interpret things. He's saying this for the purpose of gaining popularity. And then everything that was done after that in their own interpretation was an underhanded movement. Closing down the Israeli embassy in Tehran, according to these types, it appeared to the average person to be the right thing to do. But to them, now they are giving us their own esoteric interpretation of events. They said, no, don't be fooled by this. This is a gimmick. Once again, brothers and sisters, if this was being said by some uninformed person, that's, you know, you could sit down with the person very calmly and explain to them, look, you're misinformed. You're reading the events wrong. but it's coming from those who are leaders or in the position to lead. You open an embassy for Palestine, something they don't have in their own countries. And they say, once again, don't believe that. This is one of these political charades. It's not meant for the propagandistic purposes for by which it is presented. They say, we have to take away Hamas and Islamic Jihad from Wilayat al-Faqih. They look at this and they say, they see that they themselves have not done anything. What have they done? You know, when the American forces went into Iraq, all of you know, this is just 10 years ago or so, all of you know that when they went there, they went via the Persian Gulf states and the Arabian Peninsula states. The military bases that were there were used to go inside of Iraq. They use these Islamic type of figures. They use the shallow memory of some of us that said, Iran collaborated with the United States to invade Iraq. What were they doing? It's totally the other way around. But this is how they are trying to take advantage of the shallow information that is out there. And then finally, because I know my time, you gave me a certain amount of time, and I'm going to try to honor that. Within the couple of minutes that I have left, there is right now a state of fear in the Anglo-Saudi quarters. And they fear from what they call a tashayyu'. That scares them. And they are right now trying to play up this issue and what is happening in Syria. Now, I know this opens up another presentation. There's no time for that. Suffice it to say that right now, and you'll hear much, much more about sectarianism in the coming months and probably years. And they say, this is their bottom line, they say, we don't want people going to Sunni areas of the world and converting Sunnis to Shiites. And likewise, we don't want Sunnis to go to Shi'i areas of the world and convert them to Sunnis. And all of this is under that broad headline that scares them. It says, Wilayat al-Faqih. Even though in the Islamic Republic of Iran, every year there are Muslim scholars from across the fiqhi spectrum, Sunnis and Shi'is and all of their denominations, who come there and meet so that people can understand themselves. There's no gaps here in which a common enemy comes and plays the chords of sectarianism. This has been going on for the last one quarter of a century. And the final result is the Arabian client regimes who report to Washington are scared of Muslims. They're scared of independence. They haven't done anything. They say they want to wean away Hamas and Islamic Jihad from Iran. Iran is supporting them. Well, why can't you support? You have over $1 trillion in the United States, which doesn't belong to you anymore. You can't give a little of that, the crumbs you can't give to the Palestinians who are living in the largest concentration camp on earth in Gaza? And you look around and you want to blame someone? Iran has built the concept, the government of Wilayat al-Faqih has built right now and is building technology. The only Muslim country in the world that has satellites in orbit. You know, we have a short surah, and all of you, I think, have memorized it. قُلْ أَعُوذُ بِرَبِّ الْفَلَقِ. And then at the end, وَمِنْ شَرِّ حَاسِدٍ إِذَا حَسَدٍ. That's where we are today. We have the trouble and the problem of people who are viciously jealous of others who have relied upon Allah. This didn't come easy. There were hundreds of thousands of shuhada. No one can forget them. And they turn around and they say, Iran is our problem. They say, Wilayat, again, these are their words. I'm not trying to play around with words here. They say Zionism and Wilayat al-Faqih. They didn't say Jumhuri Islami. They didn't say Al-Jumhuriya al-Islamiyya. They didn't say the Islamic Republic. They said Wilayat al-Faqih. And I'm sorry, my time has run out. I will end with a salah ala Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you very much, brothers and sisters. Another area in the life of the Imam, which I think is extremely important, and comparing that with what we have today makes it much more crucial to understand. And that is, Muslims, look, we are very peaceful people. Don't let anyone come and fool you and say, look, Muslims are terrorists by second nature, Muslims are trigger happy, Muslims are fundamentalists, and all of this other imagery that they try to throw at us. We are so peaceful, so to speak, that our understanding of being peaceful has turned into wars against us. That's how peaceful we are. What do they expect us to do? And they, here is the point. Imam al-Khomeini, may Allah rest his soul in peace, he identified the enemy. I wish we were living in a world that had no enemies. That would be a dream come true. If we live, that would be utopia. If we lived in a world where we just simply don't have any enemies. I'd like to say that. I'm sure everyone would like to say that. Hey, look, I don't have any enemies. That would be fine. Who would object to that? Is there anyone who would object to that? Of course not. But the fact is, you look around, we have plenty of enemies. I don't have to go down the list. I'm sure in your mind you can immediately think of five or six at least, where there are occupations and invasions and bloodletting and refugees and orphans and widows in the millions. You look at this state of affairs and you say, is this an act of nature? Is it an act of nature that the Muslims are the largest refugee problem in the world? How did that happen? The result of occupations and invasions and warfare. And so we have this. So there are enemies. There are enemies out there. We have enemies. Now, if we can finally agree to this point, we do have enemies. Can Mr. Confidence and Courage out there please stand up and tell us who our enemies are? And when we look at the leading class in the Muslim countries all over, who is it that stands up and says, look, This is our number one enemy. Besides knowing we have enemies in the plural, who's the number one enemy, and who's the number five enemy, and who's the number 10 enemy? Please tell me, I want to know. We haven't had leaders who will stand up and classify these enemies for us. Al-Imam did. إِنَّ الشَّيْطَانَ لَكُمْ عَدُوٌ فَاتَّخِذُوهُ عَدُوًا. Indeed, the shaitan for you is an enemy. Therefore, designate him as an enemy. I think we have some questions here. And we have plenty of them, I think. Unless there's a, a filtering process here. I don't know what's going on. Okay, let me just take them the way they came. I'm not choosing any question before or after any. I'm just going by what I was given. First, and I have to be short because there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 questions here. There's more coming too, he says. Okay. Can you explain or identify how Muslims can overcome the fear to speak out? That's a very challenging question. The simple answer to that is just be a normal human being. That's all. Just be normal. If you are normal, then this artificial or this imposed fear will no longer be there. At least in the proportion that it is in today, will no longer be there. You're normal. If something is threatening, you say something is threatening. If someone is coming to occupy your land and throw you out of your home, you're not so scared as to make believe none of that is happening. You're normal. You say, yeah, someone's coming to take over. Someone's coming to kill me. Someone's coming to expel me from my country. Just be normal. Fear, let me tell you, fear is something that comes natural in human nature. But fear cannot overcome your rationality and your responsibilities. That's when fear is no longer justified. You see, if I can go at length, answering this question. وَلَنَبْلُوَنَّكُمْ بِشَيْءٍ مِّنَ الْخَوْفِ. Allah says that we're going to test you with something of fear, with a portion of بِشَيْءٍ مِّنَ الْخَوْفِ. He didn't say وَلَنَبْلُوَنَّكُمْ بِالْخَوْفِ وَلَنَبْلُوَنَّكُمْ بِشَيْءٍ مِّنَ الْخَوْفِ. Okay, fine. You have a transit moment of fear, or you have a short period of time of fear. Normal, that's natural. But that cannot become an obsession. You're fearing all the time, what do you know? We can't go here, we can't say that, you can't do anything. At the end, you might as well just sit in the corner in your home and not do anything. That's not acceptable. لا تخافا إنني معكما أسمع وأرى. Musa and his brother, two prophets, they were facing up to the Pharaoh, the leader of the world at that time. They feared. They feared because they're going to go to speak to the commander-in-chief, they're going to speak to the chief executive, they're going to speak to the most important power in the world. So their human nature had fear in it. And Allah told them, relax, take it easy, chill out. إِنَّنِي مَعَكُمَا لَا تَخَافَا إِنَّنِي مَعَكُمَا أَسْمَعُ وَأَرَى. Don't fear, I'm with both of you. I can see and I can hear. This was the character of the imam when these events, you know, what's going to happen? You're going to land. This is what they said to him. They said, you're going to land in Tehran. We don't know what's going to happen to you. When he went from Paris on the plane, it's going to land. He said, we don't have our security people out there. We don't know if it's going to be an assassin from this military right now that's upset. Things didn't go their way. We don't know if there's going to be spies, informers, you know, up to no good. Innani ma'akuma asma'u wa ara. And another question says, what is the difference between wilaya and walaya? Okay, I hope you know a little Arabic. I'll give you a short answer to that. Wilaya, both of them come from the same source, tawalla. But one of them designates something physical, and another designates something conceptual. Al-walaya is conceptual. Walayatul faqih. Like here, the United States, you say, for those of you who know a little Arabic, al-wilayat al-mutahida. A wilaya is a geographical area. That's the difference between walaya, the concept itself, or the geography itself. Do you believe war is going to happen in Iran because they do not like Iran to be the strongest Islamic country with great technology? You know, this question, especially in the past several months, has been on, I think, many people's minds. Is there going to be a war? Because from time to time you hear the media, the mainstream media, either playing up the issue of war, you think the war's going to happen any day now, or they play it down saying, nah, this thing has faded away, nothing's going to happen. Let me give you my take on this. I think that there is an active war plan, particularly sponsored by the Zionist Israeli types. They want a war by hook and by crook. And they don't want to fight the war themselves. They want the United States to fight that war for them. And the United States, this is an election year. And the US public has had it with wars. After almost a decade in both Afghanistan and in Iraq, there's a war weariness in the public. Latest surveys and polls show that there's between 63 and 69% of the American people that say the US should withdraw its troops from Afghanistan and Iraq, and there should be no more foreign wars. This is the longest war. The US presence in Afghanistan has been the longest US war in US history. So you add this war fatigue in the American public, and you add the cautiousness that precedes an American election, and you can easily conclude that war may not happen before the elections. But that doesn't mean that the Israeli Zionist types have given up on the idea. They'll bide their time, and they'll wait for the right circumstances to launch a war. So my answer to that question is, be prepared for war. If war happens, be prepared for it. If it doesn't happen, we're prepared. No one's going to launch a war. They are going to launch the war. And if they do, you have to be ready. What can you offer to the believers of Walayat al-Faqih who feel hesitant to organize politically and socially in the US around the true revolutionary Muhammadi Islam? How do we lift the community out of the depths of this fear? Shukran, as-salam. You know, the the establishment in this country is very paranoid nowadays. And there are laws to this land, and these laws now are almost being remade. There's something called the Patriot Act. There's this recent National Defense Authorization Act that the highest levels of government here want opponents of the government, whether they're Muslims or non-Muslims, they want them to fear standing up for their rights. And there's a lot of information concerning this, something like establishment of concentration camps and all of this. And this has trickled down into this fear that we're speaking, that we spoke about. Muslims begin to fear, hey, look, if we are going to meet and talk, then something bad is going to happen to us. Something bad. What's the worst thing is going to happen is some law enforcement officials are going to come and say, you're under arrest, or we are going to detain you, and there's no access to lawyers, to court, or to anything else. Well, you have to make up your mind. Do you fear something like that? You have nothing. You have done nothing wrong. No one has done anything wrong. Meeting with someone else and speaking to someone else, that's by any legal reference, that's not a crime. No one is plotting any act of terrorism or violence or anything of the sort. All that Muslims want, if they want to meet, is to set the record straight, just to state the facts that are not stated in public. That's all we want. What does anyone want besides? And then from there on, things will develop. If we gain a popularity, if millions of people begin to see the world our way, and the Zionists become the occupiers of Palestine, and Palestine has to be liberated, and Palestinians have the right to return to their home, and Al-Quds, Jerusalem, is not an exclusively Jewish city, all of this, this is what everyone is saying. Should I be criminalized for saying something like, if they want to criminalize me just because I'm saying something like that, and then the consequence is I go to jail or to prison, okay, fine. You'll know, the world will know, everyone will know that right now just speaking the truth lands you up in jail. Yeah, and you have a choice. Are you going to live with that? Oh, I don't want to say the truth. There's a bigger jail 70 or 100 years down the road. Which one do you prefer? Yeah, I'll just give a note here just to let you know that my time is running out. I have several more minutes left. Can you relate the Syrian situation with Iran and explain it? Well, I don't know if I can do that in a few minutes. But here's what I'll say on Syria. I know it's a hard subject to speak about because there's so many details to it, and it's not a clear-cut issue one way or the other. But this way I'm going to summarize it, and I know even by summarizing, I don't even know if I should answer this question because it may generate much more questions that we'll not be able to deal with. But I'll give you the benefit of the doubt and say that, the Syrian regime is not a representative government. Just like the regime in Bahrain, it's not a representative government. I think these two issues make it easier to understand. Some Muslims, if you tell them those who are governing in Syria don't represent their own people, some people can understand that very quickly and easily. Others have difficulties with it. You say the same thing of Bahrain, the two groups of people will have the same exact ease or difficulty in understanding the condition. I mean, there might be a little solution here. Change the two set of rulers. Put the rulers who are in Syria and Bahrain, the ones in Bahrain and Syria, and see if anything can be solved. Obviously, it's not that, you know, simple, but that's one issue. The other issue is the Syrian government has been, and this is why it is in the position it is in today, it has been an extension of the policies of the Islamic Republic in as far as the liberation of Palestine is concerned. So you have a negative on one side, you have a plus on the other side. And between the plus and the negative, you have right now certain agendas that are at work. There's the American administration and there's the Saudi regime. Both of them, of course, in addition to the Israeli catalyst, you have these powers that cannot tolerate a human mass that extends from the Islamic Republic of Iran to the Mediterranean. That would mean Iran, Iraq, Syria, and Lebanon, plus the Palestinians. They don't want to see this mass of people becoming what they always use the word existential threat. If ever there was going to be an existential threat to the Zionists, it would be that massive potentials, resources, populations, and military striking force. So to throw a monkey wrench into this developing mass of people, they tried their best in Iraq, it didn't work. Just like in today's world, in right now, today, yesterday, and tomorrow, you hear in Arabia calls for jihad, go to Syria for jihad against the Alawi regime in Damascus. Oh, we heard the same thing just 9 years ago, but instead of going to Iraq and to Syria, said go to Iraq. It's deja vu all over again. So what they want to do is they came Hezbollah in 2006. The Israelis went full force, they didn't do a damn thing. And then they went against Hamas in Gaza. Cast Iron, that was the name of that operation there. In 22 days, they didn't do anything. Hamas is still there, Hezbollah is still there. I figure, and then they speak about, hey, let's go to the source, let's go to Iran, but Iran is too far, we're going to have logistical problems, it may open up a Pandora's box, things may get out of control and all of this. So what is left? Oh, Syria is left, let's try this. We can work on this, we can break the backbone of this emerging political willpower by concentrating on Syria. So the American regime, the Israeli regime, and the Saudi regime find common purpose right now to ride the wave of the victimhood of the Syrian people to dislodge a government that it only concerns them that they are an extension of the Islamic policies emanating from the Islamic Republic to liberate Palestine. For those of you who understand Arabic, I always summarize it like this. Imam Ali alayhi salam said, and I have to finish with this. Some more questions here. When those who historically are known as al-Khawarij, when they said, La hukma illa lillah. Remember there was in history, if you can go back to history books, and there was the arbitration, and the Khawarij came out and said, what's all of this fuss about? Ali and Muawiyah both should be sidelined, and if all of this fighting is about governance, governance belongs to Allah, not to human beings. Then they brought this word, this statement, this sentence to al-Imam, and he said, كَلِمَةُ حَقٍّ يُرَادُ بِهَا بَاطِلٍ. It's a statement of truth But the intentions belying it are invalid, are batil. To sum up the Syrian issue, I know this irritates a lot of people, and I've given this a thought before I said it, but this is the way I summarize it. What's going on in Syria is a movement of people who want a representative government. It is thawratu haqq yuradu biha batil. And as far as the Syrian government is concerned, it is hukumatu batil yuradu biha haqq. That pretty much summarizes it all. I know I may have touched on the nerves of some people. I don't intend to get on anyone's nerves except to express the truth. If I'm wrong, I'm just like any one of you. Come up to me and you tell me, I think you're wrong on that. Let's correct it. Wallahu yaqulu al-haq wa huwa yahdi al-sabeel. Wa sallallahu ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you very much once again.